This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. A lot of baseball fans who marveled at Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire's race to break the Major League home run record in 1998 held lingering suspicions that baseball's power surge was really driven by steroids. Over the past 2 years, any illusions about baseball's home run binge have been swept away by player confessions, a federal investigation, and eventually congressional hearings into steroid use. My guest Howard Bryant reconstructs baseball's tainted decade in his new book, Juicing the Game: Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Bryant says signs were clear for years that players were bulking up on chemical additives, and those running the game were too busy making money to worry about it. Bryant is a sports columnist for the Boston Herald and the author of an earlier book, Shut Out, A History of Race and Baseball in Boston. Well, Howard Bryant, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I remember in 1996 when all of a sudden this outfielder on the Baltimore Orioles, Brady Anderson, who'd been had a history as a singles hitter, suddenly was just blasting balls out of the ballpark, leading the majors, I think, in home runs. And I think a lot of people began to wonder if something different was happening with the game. Give us a sense of how striking the explosion of power hitting was in the 90s.
Well, I think the best way to describe it from today's perspective, from a 2005 perspective, is when you look back at the years 1995 to 2002, you had home runs that were being hit at a level unseen in the history of baseball. You had players hitting home runs. It used to be, for any baseball fan, a real accomplishment, a real Everest-like accomplishment to hit 50 home runs. And in 1995, starting with Albert Bell and moving all the way to 2002 with Alex Rodriguez, the player for the New York Yankees now, but he was with Texas at the time, you had someone hit at least 50 home runs in every season during those years, which had never been accomplished in baseball history before. You had one player, Sammy Sosa, hit 60 home runs three times. Babe Ruth never did that. Hank Aaron never did that. Willie Mays had never done that. And what was more amazing during this period was that not only did Sammy Sosa hit 60 home runs in three different seasons, but in none of those years did he win a home run title.
Came up short with 60. Wow. We've known about steroids and performance-enhancing drugs for years in the Olympics, and there was, you know, that was believed to be used in pro football. But for a long time, there was this sense that that steroids didn't that the kind of skills that baseball required really were not likely to be improved by steroids. Right? I mean, it was thought to be a different kind of game.
Exactly, and the question had always been in baseball. It wasn't really a question. It was almost something more of a declaration. These drugs may help you run fast. These drugs may help you lift more weights. These drugs may help you be stronger. They may give you greater athletic. They may enhance your athletic gifts, but they won't help you be a good baseball player. Now, this is incongruous on its face. And in fact, in light of what we know today, it's ridiculous. But this was the argument that had been pushed forward by baseball players, by executives, by media, by so many very influential entities, that it became fact.
I wonder if for many years some baseball players maybe didn't take them because there was a belief that it was a different kind of thing, that bulk would make you less flexible. Hank Aaron, you know, hit all those, the all-time home run leader. Well, you know, was not a bulky guy.
Well, no, and it's a great point, because what I found so fascinating in the book, and one of my favorite parts of the book, was recognizing that within 5 years, between I'd say 1988, 89, and 1994, 150 years of conventional wisdom in baseball went out the window, that lifting weights couldn't help you, that you were going to be too big, too bulky, too muscle-bound to swing at the baseball. And in fact, in the old days, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, players who lifted weights were not only ridiculed, but they were often fined by their teams.
Wow.
For conduct detrimental to the ball club, that they weren't helping themselves. If you talk to Joe Torre, the manager of the Yankees, he'll tell you that you were never supposed to lift weights. It was one of the biggest no-nos in baseball. You were not supposed to do it. By 1988, with Jose Canseco and the Oakland A's and Mark McGwire and these huge muscle-bound players, that you had old-timers looking at this team and it looked like a football team. They had never seen baseball players so big. And within 5 years of that, not only did you have baseball players lifting weights before and after games, which was unprecedented, but you had entire teams that were buying nutritional supplements and buying these protein shakes and enhancing their weight rooms all over baseball.
You know, a lot of attention has focused on superstars who are believed to have used steroids and set records. But I imagine that, you know, there are lots and lots of baseball players who the public don't know who've spent years at the margins of the game, in and out of the minor leagues, trying to get their shot at the majors. And I'm wondering, is there evidence to believe that those folks were using, I mean, the mediocre player or almost good enough players were using steroids to give them that jump and help them make it to the big leagues?
Those are the players that were probably using the steroids even more. This is an economic story. The minimum salary in Major League Baseball is $300,000. Just to get there, once you become a Major League player, that is your salary. When you're not a Major League player, your salary is between $800 and $1,000 per month. So you can see the difference between being a minor league player and being a Major League player. And what began to happen in baseball during this decade was a feeling among these players, not the great players, Barry Bonds with anabolic steroids, Barry Bonds without anabolic steroids is still one of the greatest baseball players you've ever seen. The real story happened on the margins with these players who were on the fringe, and they began to tell themselves, I have to use these drugs in order to compete with the guy next to me. I may be completely opposed to this. I may know that it's dangerous for me. I may know that one day it may possibly kill me or hurt future generations of my children. But I need to do this because it's the only way that I'll be able to compete at the major league level and receive that big contract.
Did you get to know minor league players that were in this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember, in fact, one of my favorite players was a young man named A.J. Hinch, who was a catcher with the Oakland A's in 1998. And A.J. told me when I was researching this book that he had a conversation with his wife one day, and he told her that I'm going to make a decision that's going to affect this family. I am not going to use these drugs, even though I'm convinced that if I do, I'm just good enough that I could get one of those three-year, $10 million contracts, and this family would be set for life. And those types of conversations have been going on throughout baseball during this decade, because what began to happen was players began to look at each other, and they began to wonder who was competing on the level, who was not, and what did I have to do to compete with those players who weren't.
In the 90s, what was Major League Baseball's drug testing policy, if any?
Baseball did not have a drug testing policy in the 1990s. It wasn't until 2002 that baseball had finally decided that it could negotiate a comprehensive drug testing agreement with its players' association. And what I found very interesting about that was the motivation for this. When I listened to the various people that I interviewed for the book, the commissioner and a lot of his associates and the owners of the game and the players and everybody, we were always told that baseball did not have a drug problem. Then you realize in 2000 there was a key meeting between the commissioner and a lot of his medical officials, the team doctors and trainers from other teams. And that was in December of 2000. And they went around the room and the commissioner asked them, you know, from a health standpoint and from the standpoint of the tools that you need to do your jobs. What's the most important thing that you're being faced with? And almost to a man, they told the commissioner that the rising use of supplements, anabolic steroids, human growth hormone was the number one problem that was facing them, and that was the commissioner's epiphany. That was his moment. And not long after that, the vice president for labor relations, Rob Manfred, testified in front of Congress, I think in June of 2002, and said some very remarkable things that never received any type of public play, but it really spoke to what was happening in the game. Manfred testified to Congress that baseball statistically had seen a rise of injuries, had seen great baseball players, these very expensive players, staying on the disabled list even longer, that the baseball owners were costing themselves millions and millions of dollars by having these $10, $15 million ball players on the disabled list by being injured all of this time. And that to them, when their doctors had analyzed this data, suggested a rising use of steroids and supplements.
And why did prolonged use of steroids increase the risk of injuries to these players?
Well, because what these drugs do, especially when players become fanatic about weightlifting, is that in the case of very big players, that you begin to gain so much muscle mass that your body becomes too big for your frame, that your joints don't grow, your joints don't necessarily get stronger, and you begin to have muscle and tendon injuries. Dr. James Andrews, who's probably the most famous doctor in baseball who works on players, said that during one five-year period in the 90s, I believe it was from 1997 to 02, he had never seen as many muscle tendon injuries during that period as in his 35 years in baseball.
My guest is Howard Bryant. He is a columnist for the Boston Herald. His new book is called Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Boston Herald columnist Howard Bryant. His new book about the steroid scandal in baseball is Juicing the Game. One of the interesting aspects of this struggle was that the Baseball Players Union, the Major League Players Association, strongly resisted a tough drug testing policy. And a lot of people would look at that and say, well, wouldn't the players want fairness? I mean, why would they want to permit a situation in which some players are allowed to cheat?
Well, you had a couple of them. There are a couple of questions there. And the first one is that you had a players' association that was never quite convinced that steroids were the scourge that everyone believed them to be. There had never been any type of real study across the board to satisfy the union about what steroids actually did or did not do for baseball players. Even the people that I profile in the book, and I call them the Crusaders, who are the medical experts who continued to hammer down on these professional sports leagues to take this drug question seriously as a health crisis. Even they were totally and completely conflicted with each other about the long-term and short-term effects of anabolic steroids. So on the one hand, you had baseball people saying, until we know, why would we create policy? Now, to their detractors, this was a straw argument to simply not deal with the issue. Inside the game, you had players who could not agree, they could not come to any consensus on what to do with the steroid question. You had some players who said, yes, this is cheating, this is wrong, you can make $10 million a year and I can't because you're using these substances. This is not right. We all have to be playing under the same umbrella. Then you had other players who said, well, I don't want the baseball owners to test me for anything. There's no other employee in the country that gets drug tested for anabolic steroids or blood tested at all in this nation. So why should we be set under a different segment of rules? And that's where the 2002 agreement became so historic in one sense, because no one had ever believed that the players would agree to any type of testing at all, because it all came down to one thing, and it was the historic vitriol between the owners and the players. They could not come to an agreement, and at the same time, everybody in the game at some level had compromised their own integrity by not dealing with this as quickly as they needed to.
In 2002, when there was clearly evidence of steroid abuse, baseball was approaching another collective bargaining agreement. The players and the owners did agree on a drug testing regimen of sorts. Was it a serious effort? Was it likely to be effective?
Well, if you talk to the commissioner, he'll tell you that this was a passion of his, that he had decided that he was willing to allow the players to go on strike again in 2002 if they did not agree to a comprehensive drug policy. That was remarkable in of itself because of where baseball was in 1994. I think it was widely agreed upon that baseball could not afford another strike. When the agreement is ratified in 2002 in August and the players do agree to drug testing, it was so completely unsatisfying to everyone across the board because of the politics involved that the drug testing policy was widely ridiculed across the country, where a player had to test positive five times before there was any real sanction, that players were allowed to take their drug tests without supervision to some degree, that players were able to essentially time when the drug test would, you know, when they would be tested. And so it was laughable. And it was a very, very much a disappointment and a defeat for the commissioner, because his position was, we finally got something and let's build upon this. And the reaction, especially from the Olympic community, was, you've got to be kidding. You call this a drug policy? And so you begin to have the bullseye being placed upon baseball.
Well, Howard Bryant, I mean, the steroid issue really blew up in 2004 with a whole series of revelations, beginning with this, essentially was a tax investigation of a San Francisco nutritional lab. That led us to information about the great Barry Bonds taking steroids and all kinds of other things. This really kind of snowballed, didn't it?
It was the culmination of all of the different things that we had been told over the years that weren't true. We had been told that there was that drugs couldn't help you. We were told all of these different things that players weren't using. We were told that players were being persecuted unfairly by the press and by anybody else. And now all of a sudden, what you really have here is you have the players who came out and essentially outed themselves. In 2002, you had Ken Caminiti and Jose Canseco both say that almost half the league was using steroids. You had David Wells in 2003 with his book come out and say that 40% of players were using, and then he was pressured to reduce it to 20%. And now you have Balco. And with Balco, now you've raised the level of play here between, first it was a question of who was using steroids and who wasn't. Now you've got a legal story here. And now you've got the federal government involved. And once the federal government got involved, that's where you began to see the parallels to the 1919 Black Sox. That's where people began to really look at this story and say, this is something historic. And what you found was this ball of string just begin to unravel. And there was nowhere for baseball to go anymore because all of its contradictions were now being exposed by this federal government investigation that revealed that the best players in the game were using these very substances that they had always told us could not help them.
Boston Herald sports columnist Howard Bryant. His new book is Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. We have this update. Victor Conti, the central figure in the scandal centered on the San Francisco area nutritional lab known as Balco, pled guilty last week to distributing steroids, but will not cooperate with investigators or name players he might have supplied. Howard Bryant will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're talking about baseball steroid scandal with Boston Herald sports columnist Howard Bryant. His new book is Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Now, when the House Government Reform Committee decided that they were angry and were going to bring some of baseball's executives, its union leaders, and some of its big stars before the nation in congressional hearings, how did baseball executives and the players react initially when asked to appear?
Well, the baseball executives tried to compare being subpoenaed about steroid use to Iran-Contra. They were outraged. They believed that their civil liberties were being violated. The baseball players, after years of being pampered and years of being able to intimidate their way out of any serious situation, they laughed at this. They didn't believe that the Congress had any type of authority whatsoever over them, that they were untouchable. And when it became clear that the subpoenas came out, and when it became clear that this was real, that scene on March 17th was unbelievable. It was surreal, from having these players testify under oath. It was remarkable from the standpoint of just the savagery of baseball, of the congressional leaders, how upset they were. What we saw that day was the reduction of baseball as a untouchable entity. That all of a sudden you had these great baseball players who, I think I put it in my book, were scared little boys, Curt Schilling and Rafael Palmeiro and Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, who disgraced himself, because now there was nowhere to go. And you had these players forced to recognize their contradictions, and not just their contradictions, but their transgressions, because they were under oath. And they were very clear about what they could now say and what they couldn't.
Let's just take one piece of that. Describe Mark McGwire's appearance.
Mark McGwire's role as an American icon was destroyed that day. I was sitting very, very close to him. And here is a man who hit 583 home runs. There's a highway named after him in St. Louis. And he was so ridiculed by not answering questions, by refusing to even offer even the slightest bit of insight into his career, that every time he answered with the same response, "I'm not here to talk about the past," people in the gallery were giggling. During a congressional committee on national television, he had disgraced himself. And what really struck me about this was afterwards, people had asked whether or not Mark McGuire should be immortalized as a Hall of Famer. And I said to myself, if he wouldn't, on national television, under oath, speaking to his country, if he would not defend his career, why should anyone else? And I thought it was one of the saddest moments that I had ever witnessed of the day, and it said a lot about this decade. I think it was the defining moment of the decade.
Well, Howard Bryant, I mean, baseball clearly has suffered a terrible embarrassment with all this exposure. What's actually changed in the game in terms of testing, steroid use, and home run production?
Well, I think players have had enough, and I think the owners have had enough. I think that the commissioner knows that it's time to put an end to this. And the thing that we do know is that since 2002, at the end of the 2002 season, to me that was perhaps the end of the steroid era from the standpoint that not only do you no longer have 50 home run seasons, but you haven't had a 60 home run season, certainly not a 70 home run season. You see production, you see home run numbers in the aggregate going up, but the individual players who were accomplishing these remarkable feats, those numbers have gone back to normal. They've gone in the other direction. That suddenly the game is beginning to balance itself out. I don't think it's just a coincidence that, gee, with drug testing, suddenly you've had a reduction of these individual numbers. I said to the commissioner, I believe you have two problems here. The first is there a mechanism in place to allow this game to move forward? And I believe that there is, because I do think that this drug testing and all of this exposure and Congress being involved, I think finally we do have some clarity on this. But the second question is, what are we moving forward from? And the commissioner still does not believe that an investigation of this decade is appropriate. And he has that right. But I do think that until we begin to look at it a little bit more, there will always be that question. And you look at the players. What do you say to those players who played during this era that were clean? Who looked out for them? They didn't look out for themselves. The game didn't look out for them. And now you, forever, when they look at the decade that they played in, it will always be under the cloud of steroids.
Well, Howard Bryant, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Howard Bryant's new book is Juicing the Game: Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball.